The topic of tonight's talk is the lessons of the German Revolution, 1918 to 1919. Now, the reason for having this talk, largely, is because, certainly in my view, the German Revolution, as it occurred in one of the most advanced capitalist countries on Earth, was perhaps the most significant event in working class history of the last century. And that is even greater than the so-called revolution in Russia, which eclipsed the German Revolution in much of the discussion of socialists throughout that last century. So a part of the aim of this talk is to redress some of the balance and also to analyse Germany in the light of what I should be calling the Bolshevik myth, in the way in which events proceeded and in the way in which people calling themselves socialists in Germany conducted themselves. So what we're going to be looking at, first off, is how Germany arrived at having a revolution in 1918. We'll then look at the actual actors themselves, the most significant actor from our point of view, which is the German Social Democratic Party. We'll then look at some of the events of the revolution in a very general and broad chronology. And then we'll move on towards an analysis of the actual actions taken by the people during that revolution themselves, and try and draw a generalised socialist conclusion from those events. So to begin with then, to understand what happened in Germany in 1918, you have to go around about back to the year 1600. Because it's that period of history which saw what's known as the 30 Years' War, in which the German Empire, as was then, was balkanised, for want of a better word. That is, the emergent German unitary state under the Emperor and under whatever feudal magnates could achieve absolutism was broken up and destroyed in fratricidal wars between the more successful and more dominant absolutist states in Europe, particularly, in this instance, France and Sweden. For 30 years, Germany was torn apart by peasant wars, by wars between petty magnates, between knights, between Catholics and Protestants, under various guises, as the local authority tried to centralise itself. In places like France and Britain, what you had was a single city was able to come to predominance economically, socially and politically, and unite and create a national state through an absolute monarch. But in Germany, that never happened. No city gained predominance. No city gained ascendancy, which is why, up to this day, you'll have many more varied and differing approaches to the actual German language itself. Sometime in the, I think it was the 18th century, they sat down and worked out what was German language, whether or not it was Deutsch or Teutsch, or various things, how you spelt everything. Is it T or D? They had to formalise it in a way which was never necessary in English, because in English, what you had was the London dialect of a certain class was the language of England, apparently. So this left Germany, this balkanisation, this shattering of any progress, it left it about 200 years behind its contemporary neighbours, which suited them, because obviously that left Germany ripe for economic exploitation by France and by Sweden, very early in form of imperialism. What this meant was as capitalism advanced in the rest of Europe and they had successful bourgeois revolutions and began industrial revolutions and agricultural revolutions, Germany stayed very far behind. And if you read some of the early writings of Karl Marx, you'll see this very deeply ingrained in what he's talking about in Germany, how far behind it is in social, political terms with the rest of Europe. But of course, it's living alongside the rest of Europe in terms of the ideas it can import, and in terms of the fact that it has to live next door to these more successful neighbours. And this has a significant influence upon subsequent events in Germany. Because what happens next is that an attempt to unify a national German state is made by the Prussian government, under successive leaders like Frederick the Great, and then Kaiser Wilhelm and his Chancellor Otto Bismarck. Is Germany is gradually unified under a single unitary state. Now that was unified under force of arms and then forcibly industrialised through a process of what Marx and Engels frequently referred to as state socialism, but what we would nowadays know as state capitalism. That is, that Bismarck nationalised things, he concentrated capital, and he used a command economy to try and produce capitalist growth in Germany. And that was what basically occurred there. Now, what this meant was, as Germany was capitalising, as it was capitalising through a basically aristocratic state, absolutist aristocracy, backed up by the Junker class of small landowners, basically what we'd call the squirearchy over here, this called into being an advanced working class before there was actually a capitalist class prepared to make the bourgeois revolution. So in 1848, the capitalist class that took part in the revolution then, to try and create democracy, fell apart because it just didn't have the strength of will, it didn't have the strength of numbers or economic power. And so, unlike in the rest of Europe, where these sort of upheavals were going on, the Germans stayed far behind. But what this meant was two significant things. First off, that a massive, and it has to be borne in mind, massive workers' movement grew up in Germany. The Social Democratic Party of Germany, founded by LaSalle, heavily influenced by Marx and Wilhelm Liebknecht. And this organised workforce pre-existed a state power on behalf of the capitalist class. What this also meant was that the absolutist state, which isn't known for its adherence to basic human rights and political democracy, chose to pass anti-socialist laws, which not only limited what socialists could actually do and say, but limited the freedom of political action of petty capitalists, small capitalists, and your bog standard backbone of any advanced liberal party, which effectively drove them into the hands, into the arms of the Social Democratic Party of Germany, which meant that at the start of the century, the only force for democracy in Germany were the socialists. That was their pronounced cause, and that was their main banner. They were the only ones who supported democracy as an idea and a political programme. Now, when I say it was a massive movement, you can look to our own society today. If you compare it, say, with Russia in 1917, no one had heard of Lenin. He was an obscure writer of an even more obscure party that had to work in secret for the last 20-odd years. No one knew them. In 1914, 1919, in Germany, everyone knew the Social Democratic Party and they knew its prominent members. Today, if you think about it, Rosa Luxemburg would have had about the same amount of fame and notoriety as Tony Benn or Arthur Scargill among the generalised population at large. Perhaps even more so, given the degree of literacy and active political involvement. They were regularly polling massive numbers of votes. They had about 4 million members. And it wasn't so much a party as a movement and a way of life. The Social Democrats were an immense force within German society. They were an institution to themselves. And the party itself in Germany called into being the unions, as opposed to over here where unions more or less called into being their own political representative party and this sort of thing. So this was the situation that was around in 1914 when the First World War broke out, which has its own roots in the fact that Germany was balkanised at the turn of the 17th century, because Germany was catching up. Bismarck had helped it. It was developing. It was industrialised. And it was fast moving in on British and French markets. And it was demanding colonies for itself. That's what it wanted. That was its aim. It wanted to be an equal capitalist player in the world. But of course, Britain and France couldn't withstand this challenge. They couldn't put up with it. They wanted Germany put back in its place. And this directly led to the First World War. And again to the Second as well. Now, what happened in Germany then, First World War, was that the Social Democrats voted for war credits. They voted to support the war on the grounds that they were fighting Russian absolutism in favour of the gains that their own workers' movement had made. That was their argument, that they were defending the revolution, the workers' movement in Germany, against Russian aggression, just as the French workers' movement defended the home of the revolution, the French Revolution, against German militarism. These sort of arguments that rent the international socialist movement apart, left the Social Democrats each backing up their own nation in the First World slaughter. Now, this led to successive splits in the German Social Democratic Party. And this is the point where we have to introduce the leftist alphabet spaghetti that you need in order to understand the German Revolution. Because on the one hand, you've got the Social Democratic Party, henceforth the SPD. Then you've got One of the splinter groups from the Social Democrats, the Independent Social Democratic Party, or USPD. Then you've got a group from split off from the USPD, who were known as the Spartacus Bund, or later became the Communist Party of Germany, and a group that later split off from them again, which is the KAPD, that's the Communist Workers' Party of Germany. And there's also the Revolutionary Shop Stewards, among other fragmentary groups that you get in this sort of occasion. So that gives you an idea of the basic fragmentation that went on there. So what happened was, during the course of the war, a group of social democrats broke away from the main party to oppose the war. People like the son of Wilhelm Liebknecht, Karl Liebknecht, were imprisoned, as was Rosa Luxemburg, for their opposition to the war. Although Karl Liebknecht got 2 years off the Prussian state, whereas someone like Eugene Debs in America got 10 years. So that's the heart of the home of freedom and democracy for you. But in Germany, the USPD broke away. Now, it's important to realise that this was not a left-right split. Although, of course, the supporters of the war tended to be predominantly rightists, so too did supporters opponents of the war tend to be leftists within the USPD. But if you look at it this way, in the British Labour Party, Tam Dyel, who's opposed successive wars, as far as I know, has historically been on the right of old Labour. He would nowadays be seen as a leftist compared to Tony Blair, but he was an old Labour rightist, and he mainly opposes wars on the grounds of Arabism and friendliness with Yugoslavia. But this gives you a picture of the complexion. It was not a left-right split within the party. It was a war-anti-war split. But the entire left, the Spartacus League, that's Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg, predominant members of, went with the USPD. Now, what actually happened was, in January of 1918, there were strikes across Germany, big strikes, against the draconian living standards that had been imposed by the war, against the censorship, against the harshness and the degradation. And the fact is that Germany was beginning to crumble, both militarily and economically, as blockades were cutting off the food supplies. There was no way the war could continue. And towards November, this was recognised by the government, and they began to make moves towards ending the war. Now, it's one of the myths about the German Revolution, I believe, that the workers' uprising ended the war. And perhaps it did end it quicker, but the fact is that the German capitalist class were already preparing to end the war in preparation for putting down an uprising. Basically, it's a question of, do you see it as the workers consciously ending the war, or as Germany breaking, which is how the capitalists over here, Germany's will broke, and the workers are no longer prepared to put up with it. But whatever happened, the war came to an end, and Germany was allowed, as various rights at the time observed, to withdraw troops back to Germany to suppress any uprisings. This was allowed by the Allied High Command in the armistice negotiations. And what happened was as the war ended and the German government felt itself weakening, they offered the chancellorship, the Kaiser offered the chancellorship and the coalition government to the Social Democrats. They were brought into the government under Prince Max von Baden, that's his name, to restore order and to gain some of their demands. So the Social Democrats, the SPD, entered into government towards the end of the war, under no pretext of that not needing to necessarily be forced upon them. But what happened, as the war was then going to tend towards its end, on the 3rd of November, which is just 8 days before the official signatory of the armistice, the German Admiralty ordered the fleet to sea for a death and glory charge. They were determined to be good Prussian knights and see all their sailors sunk, rather than hand over the fleet to be scuppered, and rather than have some humiliating terms put upon them. Understandably, the sailors weren't having any of it. And on the 3rd of November, they rose up and instituted a sailors' council in the northern German port of Kiel. That was the beginning of the German Revolution. And from there on, it spread like wildfire across the country. City after city in the main industrial heartlands went over to either workers' or soldiers' councils. I've got a friend of mine in Germany, I'll be mentioning this again, who did some research for me, and she says that in her local paper in a town in Westphalia, they mention the uprising in Kiel on the 3rd November. And it was at first thought to be locally limited and under the influence of Bolshevist emissaries. So clearly, already within the minds of the German intelligentsia and the media sections of the German classes, the idea, and the opponents of socialism particularly, the idea that it was Bolshevik inspiration, Bolshevik insurgents that were coming along and stirring up trouble that was at the heart of the uprising, rather than the decay of German society as such. And this spread to Hanover, Osnabrück, and it was particularly concentrated on the Rhine and the heavy industrial heartlands and most of the cities, even up to the point of a huge uprising in Germany, in Berlin, sorry, which on the 9th of November saw the city covered in massive demonstrations, marching towards the Imperial Palace. What happened there was that the leaders of the Social Democrats, a man named Erbert and a man named Scheidemann, were desperately trying to take control of the situation. And what happened was that Scheidemann climbed up on the steps of the Imperial Palace and unilaterally, off his own bat, declared the Republic to the awaiting crowds. This is about half an hour before Karl Liebknecht, recently released from prison, could climb up and do the same trick himself. However, Scheidemann and Erbert successfully managed to pronounce the Republic and force the abdication of the Kaiser, and Erbert was proclaimed Chancellor of Germany. So we now had a social democrat government, SPD government, in Germany. And this is the beginning, it's very complex and it's not particularly necessary for a talk like this to go into the tedious details, but there's then follows the typical shenanigans of formation of cabinets and coalitions as the USPD with a fellow named Barth and Haase went into the coalition with Scheidemann and Erbert and formed the cabinet of the USPD and the SPD. So you had the old, what was the SPD once, in both its factions, formed a coalition government. And all the while, workers' councils were spreading across Germany. And there was a clamour on to call a Congress of Workers' Councils, which was eventually called, and started to make arrangements for an election of a constituent assembly, which of course itself was a contentious issue within the socialist movement at the time, because people like Rosa Luxemburg saw that a constituent assembly, a parliament being elected, would possibly dismantle any of the gains of the workers' councils, would hold them back. She had previously criticised Lenin for suppressing the constituent assembly in Russia, but here in Germany she was saying that to call one would be to dismantle the workers' councils, and therefore the job of socialists was to defend the workers' councils against calling a constituent assembly. But even then, when the Spartacus Bund split off and formed the Communist Party of Germany, she argued that they should contest any parliamentary elections should they occur. And this is the proof that the Communist Party in Germany was nothing like the Bolshevik Party. She was heavily defeated, her and the Central Committee, in a vote of the party by people like Otto Arula, against standing in Parliament. The KPD declined to stand in parliamentary elections and came out thoroughly against that. Of course, this is a situation now in which you've got the capitalist class, who have no faith in democracy, having never had a democratic revolution themselves. You've got the working class, who have gained all they want without a democratic revolution themselves. And this situation, you can begin the tendency that perhaps you can see leading towards, ultimately, the Nazi dictatorship of no one in Germany having a democratic tradition on which to fall back upon. No one was supporting democracy because it supported no one's ends. The workers thought they could get it through physical force. Likewise, the capitalists, and likewise the remnants of the nationalists and the militarists. So, the Spartacus Bund, KPD, were very clear in the need for working class self-activism. They said that every proletarian, every worker, would have to be involved in making of the revolution. This is resolutions passed at their inaugural conference. They were very clear upon the need for majority conscious involvement in the revolution for it to be successful. Their theory and policy was light years away from that of the Bolsheviks, and yet they still looked to the Bolsheviks for succour, for inspiration, and for aid, because largely, I would contest, they believed the Bolshevik myth of spontaneous workers' councils being the driving force of the Russian Revolution and spontaneous working class self-activity, as I was going to demonstrate in the case of the Spartacist uprising. What happened in the uprising? What happened in the Spartacist uprising was that they were provoked into taking on the state head on. The Prussian state decided to try and remove a USPD chief of police from the Berlin police offices. He'd been installed there by the Workers' Council in Berlin, and this was a clear attack on the Workers' Councils. And the various socialists, particularly some of the Spartacus Fund, the KPD, and the revolutionary shop stewards, it's very hard to say that, rose up on the streets of Berlin to defend Eichhorn in his role as the chief of police. And this led to what is known as the Spartacist uprising, which the Spartacus Bund actually had very little to do with, as it turns out. They either directed it was not their official policy, but their members were to the forefront, particularly Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg. In the pages of Die Rote Fahne, the Red Flag, was very forthright in pursuit of this uprising. This was a spontaneous uprising across the whole of Berlin that brought out possibly 200,000 workers onto the streets. And what happened was these 200,000 workers came out onto the streets spontaneously. They stood around for a day. No one told them what to do, so they went home. Some sailors tried to occupy various bits of the city. One occasion a sailor was told, "You can't occupy this building unless you bring me the requisite form filled in and signed." So he went back to Karl Liebknecht, got him to sign a form saying, "We have overthrown the government," signed it, and then went off. But then the kibbutz cleared off and no one took over the building. It's a total and utter cock-up. And this document later became a vast piece of incriminating evidence on the part of Liebknecht on his attempt to overthrow the government on that particular day. Now, the difference obviously comes to light immediately, which we'll draw to more attention later, of the lack of organisation that went into it. And it calls into question, typically, Leninists always say, if there had been a Lenin or a Trotsky, the revolution would have happened that day, very likely. Or at least, there would have been a repeat of the July days, and it would have all been called off until a better date. Certainly, Ebert, the Chancellor, as he was trying to get out of the city with his friends, was quite convinced that had they had their act together, Berlin would have fallen to the Spartacus League that day. There's no two ways about it, if they had taken their action sufficiently resolutely. What they did instead was, rather than occupying strategic military points, occupying the most important part of the city, they occupied the Berlin equivalent of Fleet Street. They occupied the offices of the SPD newspaper Vorwärts, I think that translates as forwards, and held that. Now this shows in part how even their thinking was still influenced by the idea that they had to win a battle of ideas, in that they took over the newspapers in order to put their propaganda out and supply socialist ideas to the working class. Although it shows on the other hand, as some critics point out, how these previous ardent supporters of free speech and opponents of censorship themselves resorted to censorship in order to fight their battles as a minority within the German working class. And what happened then was that Ebert and the SPD government put a man named Noske in charge of putting down the uprisings. He'd previously gone around the area and negotiated with various councils to try and defuse them. And what he did was he gathered together a group called the Freikorps, which was basically a private army run by certain military officers for the purpose of suppressing Bolshevism and insurgent Poles in the eastern parts of Germany. Basically, the Freikorps were psychotic. They were psychotic, they were ardent nationalists, venomous anti-Bolshevists, anti-socialists, and they were gathered together in an elite military force. And what they did was they marched into Berlin, and after a bloodbath and a battle across the streets of Berlin, it was retaken for the government, and the Spartacus uprising was ended. Right, to briefly sum up then, where we are at this moment. As a result of 300 or so years of underdevelopment, Germany arrived and actively completed its capitalist revolution in 1918 to 1919. Or you could argue it continued on this particular story until 1946, really. But this was the culmination, more or less, of the German Revolution, the end of absolutist state power, and the rise to power of the SPD, which had become the home of both the organised working class, which predated the organised capitalist class, and those sections of the capitalist class that wished to organise themselves against Bismarckian anti-socialist laws. So where we got to was the Spartacist uprising, which was misnamed because the Spartacus Bund had very little to do with it, was crushed in Berlin at the cost of the deaths of hundreds, possibly a thousand or so workers. And it's important to note here at this point why it's known as the Spartacist Uprising, as one of the books I was flicking through says. At this time, people in France and Moscow were overestimating the popularity and the power of the Spartacus Bund. And those in power, the SPD, who were calling them terrorists and the capitalists, chose to call anyone who was a dissident a Spartacist, much as 20 years ago, anyone in the Labour Party who disagreed with Michael Foot was clearly and obviously a Trotskyist. So this sort of misnaming, this sort of ideological tarring with the same brush, meant that this more or less spontaneous uprising was known as the Spartacist Uprising, and still is, rather inappropriately. Now, what happened as a result of this uprising was that the previous political prisoners, Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg, were murdered in cold blood by the Freikorps. This isn't in the field of combat. They were taken prisoner, they were clubbed on the back of the head with a rifle butt, and thrown in the river for trying to escape, Your Honour. On hearing about this, Erbers and Scheidemann shot themselves. This was terrifying for them. This is a catastrophe. If you imagine it today, like I said, imagine if in the middle of an uprising, Tony Benn and Arthur Scargill were done away with quietly. They thought that this would provoke retaliation from the workers and would cause mass uprisings. As it turns out, there were no such reprisals. The Freikorps and the SPD government consolidated its control of Berlin, and the revolution continued on under SPD management. Now, this eventually led to the elections of a constituent assembly, which Luxemburg and her friends had opposed. And I'll just give you a brief rundown of the number of seats each party gained, as reported in the February Socialist Standard 1919. The SPD got 164 seats out of 421. The USPD got 24. And then there were various fragmentary parties of the German Democratic Party, National People's Party, Christian People's Party, German People's Party, and other parties who got between 70 and 20 odd seats each. In percentile terms, nationally, the German People's Party, I believe, Centre Party, got 19.5%, whereas the SPD got a clear 40%. Now, you get various Trotskyist writers like Chris Harman, who'd have us believe that this is a result of some sort of confusion in the ranks of the working class, that the USPD and the SPD were unable to distinguish themselves from one another. And if only Rosa Luxemburg, prior to 1914, had set up a group called the Socialist Workers' Party, say, in Germany, they'd have been clearly recognisable, rather than if she'd stayed with militant, the SPD. That's the sort of thing you get from the Trotskyists. But we have to assume, for the most part, that those people who voted SPD meant to vote for the SPD. And there are comparisons with other similar situations in Spain. The Socialist Party there, the moderate, the Social Democrats, continue to get the bulk of the working class support. And in Portugal, in the middle of the revolution there, despite the fact that the Leninists actually controlled the military and the state, in repeated elections, the workers kept voting for the Social Democrats. So this is an observable trend in these sorts of upheavals of collapsing authoritarian regimes. And even though we can say with some people, perhaps Scheidemann and Herbert, or Ebert or Ebert, however it's pronounced, were consciously trying to act in a counter-revolutionary manner and restore capitalism, a good deal of the Social Democrats were committed to the reformist programme and genuinely believed that where they were going was socialisation and socialism, albeit through reforms and through support of the freest and most open democratic republic, political constitution. So that was the idea, clearly, which predominated throughout the working class and with those sections of the other classes who were still pursuing the culmination of capitalism in Germany through the means of the Social Democrats. So that's the more or less where the story of the German Revolution 1819 ends, at that point, with the elections and the stabilisation of relationships and a succession of governments from there on in, either comprising mainly of the Social Democrats or supported heavily by them. This goes on throughout the 1920s and culminates itself with the rise of fascism and Hitler. And after that, for a long period, Dave's got a book at the back there about the revolution. 1923, is it?
Yeah.
Well, what happens from there on in is there's various localised uprisings, a bit like that game where you have to bop the moles at the arcades. Well, the German state was there bopping the moles down every time they popped their head up, and it was all very fragmentary. You had things like the Bavarian Soviet, which took over the government of Bavaria, the southern German state around Munich, and they controlled that. And there's the story, of course, that they burst into the Catholic bishop's office and held a gun at his head, and that bishop later went on to be Pius XIV, who aided and abetted the Nazis during the Second World War, possibly as a result of his anti-communist experience of being held at gunpoint, some people surmise. Or theorise, at least. So that's how it continued from there on in. So if we go back a bit and finish with the chronology and try and examine the implications and the consequences of the way people acted. Well, the central question was the workers' council themselves. This is what split the workers' movement even more previously than the question of war had. On the one hand, the SPD, securing the knowledge that they have state power, weren't all that fond of workers' councils. They were for using them as an end to set up the elections, achieve political democracy, and then dismantle them. Likewise, the USPD and Kautsky, who was one of the independents, they had a similar view. And on the other hand, you've got Luxembourg and Liebknecht, who thought that the workers' council should be supported as a positive gain of the revolution. Now, the workers' councils were set up on an ad hoc basis. There was various different constitutions, various different questions about ratios of representation, who should be represented and how and why. And this is obviously because they were filling a vacuum of a lack of political control that the working class just had no means of organising for itself. What happened very often was that the Social Democrats, who were by far the biggest party with the dominant ideas at the beginning of the revolution, were the party that dominated the workers' councils by a very long way. And they won hands down, and through that control of them, were able to more or less neutralise them and use them in a fairly apathetic and passive way to simply plead with the masters. And this reflects pretty much the situation in Russia, where the Mensheviks dominated the Soviets from the beginning. But what would happen occasionally in some particularly militant areas? The USPD would have a technical majority within the council. And what would happen then is, because there were calls on all sides for workers' unity and this sort of thing, socialists working together, they would have parity. They would accept parity with the SPD on the executive, and they'd split it down the middle, half and half. Whereas the SPD, wherever they were dominant, would take all the seats and not let anyone else in. So what you have basically is, although you've got the Soviets on the one hand, pre-existing parties playing the usual political shenanigans, stitching them up and stitching up the organisation and the structure of the workers' councils on an ad hoc basis. Julius Martov, in his pamphlet that's published around the place as The State and Socialist Revolution, as translated by Integer, points out that, say, in Russia, Lenin's call of all power to the Soviets was understood as a tacit criticism of Soviets as they actually existed. And likewise in Germany, a lot of the SPD and the Spartacus types opposed the Soviets for being passive and would say, let's work outside them, let's go around them, because they were dominated by the SPD and they were no vehicle for revolutionary conduct. And on the other hand, there were the various questions of how to organise them. As Kautsky pointed out in one of the various debates about it, on the one hand, you've got soldiers' councils. Well, given that soldiers were conscripted at that time universally across all classes, soldiers' councils were a cross-class institution, the franchise of which was limited only by the statutory requirement of the army height. Both workers' councils where short artists can't vote. Likewise, the Berlin Workers' Council, the franchise extended to members of liberal professions, doctors, lawyers, writers, artists, the self-employed, and so forth. And Kautsky raises the very valid question, what happens if you're a so forth? Do you have a vote or not? It's very difficult to tell. So this was part of the argument that went on, that the workers' councils themselves lacked a certain degree of legitimacy because of their ad hoc nature and because of the fact that they necessarily were not, strictly speaking, representative. They were representative almost solely of the whims and desires and the will of the people who set them up in the first place and the ideas in the heads of those people as they constructed the actual councils. That was the main determining force upon them. So that's what happened with the workers' councils across Germany. Now we'll come at the end to the example of a small town in Westphalia, which is part of the revolutionary hotbed, to look at what happened there. So, as I said earlier, the Spartacus Bund, the Communist Party, were very clear of the need for a majority revolution and for majority involvement. But as I have just mentioned, some of them were already claiming that we should go round the Soviets in order to progress with our revolution, because the vast majority of workers were just too passive and were not wanting to put it forward, the extreme radical end of the Spartacists. And that's the sort of thing that led to the Spartacist uprising, was the revolutionary minority going off in advance on their own because of their impatience with the structures of what was going on around them. And also, within that context, they were operating under the influence of what I termed earlier the Bolshevik myth, which is that in Russia, Soviets were spontaneously formed in the minds of workers, in its most extreme case, as the genuinely discovered form of working class political organisation, and that they spontaneously and of their own accord manufactured a revolution out of their own self-activity. Now, as I mentioned earlier, what happened in the Spartacist uprising, I think, clearly demonstrates and undermines this image, because what Liebknecht and Luxemburg failed to do in Berlin was spend a couple of months planning the insurrection. Despite the claim to the contrary, it's quite clearly written in Isaac Deutsch's biography of Trotsky, he carefully laid out and planned out how to capture the city. He had a plan of attack beforehand, there was a clear command and control structure for organising the masses in the uprising. So when it happened, it went like clockwork and it all went off easily. What happened when the masses spontaneously arose in Berlin was that there was no such plan and no such structure. And it could be conceivably argued that without such vanguardist action, these sorts of spontaneous actions are not going to go in any particular direction, or at least not some central organisation, at the very least, if the organisation is democratic. But there was no plan, there was no organisation, and so people stood around and in the end did nothing, or in fact were frustrated by the inaction that they were prevented by. So the myth of what the Bolsheviks had achieved stood in contradiction to the actuality of how the Bolsheviks really had behaved, but because they fell in with it and because their opponents fell in with it, this coloured the course of the revolution. The idea of Bolshevism became one of the determinant forces, and indeed that was one of the reasons why the ruralists within the Communist Party rejected standing for Parliament, because they said, quite rightly, from their point of view, that the Bolsheviks in Russia had not needed to stand in parliamentary elections to achieve their power. All we need are workers' councils. Likewise, what this led to, as I mentioned earlier, was a system whereby the frustrated, sort of like advanced guard of the working class, the Spartacists, would go back on their own practice, their own theory, so that they would support the Berlin uprising, despite the fact that it was still only a minority of the workers, despite the fact that it meant censoring and closing down the organisation's fellow workers, and acting as a minority to impose their will, because obviously they thought that it was in everyone's interest to act courageously and in advance to achieve the ends of socialism. This is despite the fact, as I said earlier, that within the founding conference they expressly said that it required the majority of the working class understandingly cooperating with the socialist revolution. And this is, to a certain extent, the result of their spontaneism, of their desire to follow whatever someone else is doing on the ground, rather than trying to set out the course of their own events and their own ideas. So what you have is you have the various workers' councils as they're set up, and more or less determined by the ideas of the working class in advance and by the existing organisations within that society. The idea that workers' councils fall from the sky is quite a common one. As you may recall, down Comrade O'Neill asking at Comrade Worden's talk, is it true that the Mensheviks invented the Soviets in 1905? Well, I've been away and read about this. And it turns out, if you read between the lines in some of the books, yes, they did. What Trotsky says in his book on 1905 is one of the factions of the social democratic movement set them up. He didn't say which, but the book was published in 1921, so there was no way on earth he was going to say the Mensheviks did it. But the Mensheviks set them up. The Mensheviks doubtless were the forefront of setting them up again in 1917. These things don't fall from the sky. You have to look back at the sociology of the people forming them, I would suggest, to see what the motivation and what the idea behind pursuing that course of action is. And that applies heavily with the workers' councils, because obviously if a majority of those setting up the workers' councils are setting them up as a stopgap towards achieving a democratic parliamentary state, that's all they're ever going to achieve. Obviously this takes us to the party's own case, that it's not the particular form but the principles, democratic principles of organisation, that are the most important. And in Germany, where the socialist ideas were lacking, where the principles were lacking, that followed that the workers' councils were not going to be a revolutionary institution per se. Although they were potentially, but again, only as potentially as, say, any other elected body could be. So just to come to an end with a couple of points, I got a friend of mine, she lives in a town in northwest Germany called Paderborn. The home of Europe's shortest river, and it's was one of the ancient Carolingian capitals of the German Empire, and it's a small university town, a cathedral town, and heavily Catholic. But nearby places called Neuhaus and Sennelager, today where British forces are still stationed in Germany, part of the occupation forces there since the war. There was a military base, and the soldiers at this military base rose up and created a soldiers' council there in Paderborn. And it's just been emphasised, it's a soldiers' council in a backwoods town. So this is how far the revolution could actually spread in Germany. Even in a quiet country district, there could still be this sort of uprising. Obviously because soldiers come from all parts of Germany and concentrate various backgrounds within them. And they refuse to take orders, they set free fellow soldiers under arrest, they questioned the old order, they hunted down officers, tearing their shoulder insignias and sabres off, and forced them to acknowledge the new social order. And they stormed the court, prison, and liberated the civilian prisoners as well. And that's the day of that. That's 8th of November, all that happened. The next morning, they formed a Soldatenrat, or Soldiers' Council, like there was in Kiel, made up of 26 men. And they took control of order in the city and made sure everything continued as normal. They started from the, according, this is her words, according to its democratic self-image, the Soldiers' Council was prepared from the start to share its power with the Bürgertum, middle classes, bourgeoisie, and the Arbeiterschaft, the working classes, of Paderborn. They established the Paderborner Volksrat, Paderborn People's Council, on the 20th of November in the Rathaus, the town hall. And there were 78 people there, and the chair was someone called Strüfing, a social democrat trade unionist. The majority there, though, were the local burghers, apparently. The Zentrum People's Party got 81% of the vote. And so this is the same sort of vote as they would have had before the war, before the uprising. So this sort of event passed them by in this area, which I should point out is just a couple of kilometres down the road from Dusseldorf or Cologne, which would have been obviously huge working class centres themselves. And across the entire of Westphalia, the Centre Party got 42% of the vote, with the SPD getting 30.5% of the vote, compared to their 40% of the vote nationwide. What must this serve to demonstrate is the extent to which the old order could continue, the extent to which the disturbances of the uprising managed to spread even to this particularly reactionary area, in which the way in which, despite the minority uprising, it happened to concede to the character, the culture, and the economy of the local area in which the insurgents found themselves. And I think it serves just as something that's not taken from the standard history books to show as a good example of how far the German Revolution in 1918 spread throughout Germany, which is a massive sweeping change, but not that much change, it seems, in that one example, in the consciousness of most people. I'd like to end up by quoting from the German Council Communist Paul Mattick. "It was only in retrospect, after the defeat of the revolutionary minority, that it became clear that the revolutionary upheavals had been a lost cause in advance." That's his summation. He says that the revolutionary minority continued to try and act in revolutionary manner to provoke uprising in order to spread the ideas and persuade their fellow workers to join with them, but in the end, they got their asses kicked. The ultimate conclusion of the German Revolution in 1919 was that the ideas and practices which had predominated beforehand shaped the character of that revolution in its organisational and political form and shaped its outcome. And also, I would add, decisively, the control of military power on the behalf of the Scheidemann Ebert government, with their control of the Freikorps and their capacity to unleash it upon a German minority occupying Berlin, was also decisive, and a bloody decisive stroke at that. Thank you very much.